My name is Ralph E. Moody, and I'm presently a Superior Court judge in Anchorage and have been more than 20 years. I was born in Vance, Alabama, which is between near Birmingham, Alabama, on November 23, 1915. Before I was a year old, we moved to Chinchula, Alabama, which is about 18 miles north of Mobile. Later we moved to Georgetown, Alabama, when I was about 2 or 3 years old, where my father was a sharecropper. During the World War I, with the help of my older brothers and sisters doing the farming, he got a job in the shipyard in Mobile and carried on the sharecropping farming, and later got out of that and got into the turpentine business. While I was at Georgetown, I attended the first grade with my eldest sister as teacher, her first year as teacher. I was my first year in school. And also the second year. On the third year, went by bus to Wilmer, Alabama, which is about 10 miles away. Went through the third and fourth grade there. Then in fifth grade, we moved back to Chinchula, where my dad was in the turpentine business, what they call a rider. In other words, he supervised the people dipping turpentine. And RID, I rode around on a horse and checked all the people who were dipping the tar from the pine trees. And they'd put it in a barrel, and the trucks or wagons would haul it in to the still where they reduced it to rosin and turpentine. So he was in that business while I was in the fourth, fifth, through the midway through high school. I went to fifth and sixth grade in Chinchula again. We moved back there. Then in seventh grade, I went by car with a teacher from that area who was teaching Citronelle 13 miles away, and finished the seventh grade in Citronelle, which is about 26 miles from Mobile. They didn't have a high school. They had a high school in Citronelle, and they had one in Mobile. Mobile was a much larger and perceived to be a better high school. So I then rode the train, which came through the little town of Chinchula. Got it every morning at 6:30, and rode it to Mobile, and then had a 3 mile either walk or skate or by streetcar to the high school. Got off at 3 o'clock, and I caught the train back at, and I caught the train back about 6 p.m. going back to my home. So I had about a 12-hour day.
How many brothers and sisters?
I had two brothers. I had a twin brother who died when he was 5 years old. Spinal meningitis. I had a brother which was 6 years older than I, and three sisters, all of them older than I was. I was the youngest in the family. So I went 4 years to high school, Murphy High in Mobile, finished there, then went to the University of Alabama, pre-law school, went to law school. Took 2 years out during the Depression in 37 to 39. Finished my first year in law school and finished law school in June of 1940. Well, my brother was an attorney, and of course, when I was going to high school, I had about 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours every afternoon, and I sold papers. When I wasn't selling papers, I went down to the courthouse and stayed around the courthouse and watched cases tried and got to know the system pretty well. And my brother was an attorney also, but primarily because I was interested in it, because I just got lots of contact through personal interest when I was in high school.
What kind of reputation did lawyers have in
Alabama? Oh, I think they were considered, along with bankers, and lawyers and bankers were probably considered the high professionals in those days.
How much older was your brother?
He was 6 years old. Yeah, he finished the same year that I started law school. He finished in 1933, and I started in 1933. Well, of course, he hadn't had any experience except going to school, and what you perception you get of what legal education is from being a student. So, because he finished in June and I started in September, so he hadn't had too much experience. But he didn't discourage me. It was from the standpoint, if you like it, and go ahead. Of course, I had 2 years to make up my mind in pre-law and decided to go into it, and I'm glad I did. Never been sorry about it.
When you say 2 years of pre-law, is that you just had to do 2 years of pre-law?
That's right.
3 years of law school?
That's right. That's right. You had your option in those days. You could do 2 years pre-law, or you could go 3 years, and first year of law school you got your AB or BS or whatever it was, and then 3 years in law school.
What did your brothers and sisters do?
My oldest sister was a school teacher. She became a school teacher the first year I started school, and I say she taught me her first year. She was teaching in a one-room school, by the way, 7 grades.
Was that in
Mobile? No, that was in Georgetown.
What about your other
sister? The other sister was a nurse, registered nurse. She served all over the nation in veterans hospitals, in the Baptist hospitals. She served in Savannah, Seattle, Chicago, New Orleans. She had quite a career in being a nurse. And one was just a housewife. She finished high school. She married, and she had 5 children.
Did your parents encourage you to go on to?
Yes, very much so, because my dad could not read and write. He finally learned to write his name. My mother, he went to school 4 months of his life. My mother only had 6th grade education, but that was something that encouraged all of us to get an education. And all of us did. I guess her sister that married and had a family, she finished high school, but that was her choice to do that. And my sister, who was a teacher, finally got a readiness. She was just out of high school. In those days, you only had to be out of high school. But she went and got a college degree during 50 years she taught school. And of course, the other sister was a registered nurse, and my brother and I both got a college education. So I think they were quite proud of, and they encouraged us. And that's, you don't see that too much, you know, in people that aren't educated. Or you didn't in those days. Maybe you do more than you did.
What did you do for the 2 years, 37 to 39?
I worked with the Corps of Engineers, U.S. Corps of Engineers, on the Tennessee Tom Bigby River Canal Survey from Tupelo, Mississippi, all through Mississippi, Alabama. Tupelo. We started up in Tupelo and came all down through Columbus, Mississippi, Demopolis, Alabama. In other words, we were making a survey of the rivers that they could connect by canals to get in there. And they're still working on that today. That's been over 40 years ago, and they just made an appropriation, which they hope will finish it and open it up now in the next few years. So we were on the beginning of it in 1937.
How'd you get involved
with it? Well, I guess you'd say through the back door, knowing someone. My brother was married to the daughter of the administrator, the stepdaughter of the administrator of the Corps of Engineers office in Mobile, and that's where I got the job during the Depression. Real big salary too. $3 a day, and you pay your own room and board, it furnishes your transportation.
Was that a big salary then?
It was. I paid $10 for room and board. That's three meals a day and room, and so that's $10 a month. No, $10 a week. That's $40 a month. So I all had my room and board. So I had $60 left, and I saved enough money to go back to college.
So you started college at 33.
Yeah. Yeah, I went 33, 33, 34, 34, 35, and started in 36, went a half a year, and the job came available, and I was short of money, so I went out and stayed out actually 2 years and went back in January of 39 and finished in June of 40. Took the bar in Alabama. Well, you didn't have to take the bar in those days. If you graduated from the University of Alabama, all you had to do was to pass an oral exam. You went before a board of the bar.
Was it?
Well, it was. It could be tough. I think I was in about 30 minutes. They asked. I guess if they wanted to flunk you, they could. No. I finished in 1940. I had joined the National Guard when I was in college because it paid $1 a week per drill, and that was lots of money in those days. So it gave me $4 a month. Plus, we got to go to summer camp, and it paid $3 a day for 2 weeks during the summer. And if we got called up for any special duty, we got paid $1 a day plus our food. Wasn't much, but $1 meant a lot those days. And so the National Guard was called up in 1940, and we had to go to camp every year for at least 2 weeks, and so they called us up. The week I graduated, they told us we were going to have to go to camp in July for 2 weeks. While I was in camp for the 2 weeks, and that Mobilization Act of 1940 was passed, and they told us we were going to have to be called into federal service in November, so I just didn't, and they extended our training to a month, so it was in July, it was mid-July, it was September almost when I got back, so I just got ready to go into service, and I went to service on November 25th, 1940. And got out in April 1946. Started in service. I was in the Signal Corps first. I started out as company clerk. I went in as private Signal Corps, 31st Signal Company of the 31st Division, Alabama National Guard. Became company clerk in October of 1941. I went to Officer Canada School, Signal Corps in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. I was commissioned a second lieutenant on in January of 48. Yeah, in January of 42, commissioned second lieutenant. I served as personnel officer in the regiment in which I went to Officer Canada School. In other words, I just walked out as an officer, took over the personnel management of the regiment, which consisted of 52 companies. I was at there for, out in January of 1942 until New Jersey, Fort Monmouth, until about 1943. I then became adjutant in that company, which was the assistant to the commander, the regimental commander. In other words, I was running his, the whole administrator of the whole 52 companies. I did that until they put out an order that everyone who hadn't been overseas had to go overseas in 1940, so I transferred down into one of our companies as a company commander for about 60 days, and while I was there, they formed a signal construction battalion. A colonel from Puerto Rico was designated commander, and I noticed that he was around my company for a long time. Finally, he said, "I've selected you to be my executive officer." He said, "We're supposed to support you in Camp Forest, Tennessee. In 30 days, and I'm going on vacation." I got to know him pretty well. So I didn't know what he was there for initially, but he was coming in.
What was he there for?
Well, he's there to observe me. He knew the colonel, and he knew the colonel who was commanding the regiment in which I had been adjutant, and I'm sure he asked me if he had. But anyway, he observed me. He told me he went on vacation and something happened. That's about the time of the, just before the breakthrough in the German breakthrough on Christmas, they broke through and had that terrible deal, and the outfit that we were supposed to go on in, going in sep- what was a breakthrough in the air in the in 1944 at Christmas time on the Germans made their last attempt to break through the lines in Europe. And my unit, which he was late in getting back, and they had to send it over, and somebody else got in there, and they all got wiped out in that German breakthrough, and we were just fortunate, I guess. He was on vacation, and we never did get there. We got assigned another unit later, but I mean, it's just showing
fortunate
how fortunate it was. So we went overseas. I went in overseas in October, I guess in 1944, stationed in England, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Germany. We were the Army Communication Signal Company, Signal Battalion, Heavy Construction Battalion. That was construction of pole line construction in the Army area way back to the lines of the 15th Army. Until the Germans surrendered, at which time we were processed. And all of our equipment.
You did the pole line construction?
Pole line construction. We did lots of pole line construction of telephone lines behind the lines for the 15th Army and Signal Corps. And after that, we were ordered to Japan, to the Philippines. We left on think we left on, we were on a Dutch ship for 63 days without getting off. And we got from Marseille to the Philippines, to fly Dutch New Guinea. But we were 2 days out of the Panama Canal when the Germans surrendered. And on DE Day, and we thought sure they'd turn us back. We got the canal and they sent us right on to New Guinea, up the Philippines. We got in there 63 days after we left, without ever getting off, and you're talking about a bunch of really unhappy people. We thought they'd turn us back. Well, they surrendered, that's what, and they surrendered, oh, wait a minute. No, the Japanese surrendered 3 days out of Panama Canal. We were on the way going to Japan, and they surrendered. We thought sure we'd be turned back. They sent us on over, went by the Dutch New Guinea. I don't know why they did all that, but we got to the Philippines, and we sat out in Manila Bay for 5 days. Finally, somebody came on and said, what are you doing here? You should have been sent back to San Francisco from the Panama Canal. Well, fine, we'll leave now. I was executive officer on that boat in charge of all that. I said, well, we'd be glad to go back. He said, oh, no, the people have been over here much longer than you have. We'd only been gone from the States for a year. So they took us off, and that was in September. They took us off in September 3rd. No, but it had been 3 days after the... September 3rd, I think the Japanese surrendered in August sometime. I think we were taken off the ship and sent north of Manila, and we stayed there for almost 4 months before we got back. I got back Christmas Eve. I got back to New Jersey coming by boat and train across the country. I got back New Jersey Christmas Eve of 1945. But we said, well, nothing to do. Took us off a boat and put somebody else on. Really big foul up. Well, tried to keep our troops from getting in too much trouble. Of course, we run the point system then, and I'd spent almost 5 years in the States, and I didn't have enough points. I'd still been in there, I think, if they hadn't done away with those points. But finally, they started sending all of us back. And then I started processing getting out. But it was actually April before I got out. They moved me around. Well, I went to... I got back to Fort Dix. They processed me out of Fort Dix back to Fort Monmouth and put me there on some local duty, the fort duty of just administrative duty while they were getting ready to get us out. I actually got out, I think, sometime in April, 1946. Well, I went down to Washington and looking for a job with the government. Since I'd been away from home, I'd never started practicing. It'd been great changes down there. Frankly, I knew very few people considering, because Mobile had grown from about 70,000 to 300,000 people during the war, because they'd built a big naval station there. So I went down. I was looking for a job with the government until I could decide what I wanted to do. And Officer Price Administration had an opening in Honolulu and one in Anchorage. And I chose the one in Honolulu, and they wired and said they had someone. They wired back and said they always hired someone, so I took the one in Anchorage about the equal.
What did you do for the
opening? I was checking on compliances with price controls. First thing I did was go to bars and bars in Anchorage and bought liquor to see if they were overcharging. And that's first time I've ever been furnished money to buy liquor. And I could drink it too, but I couldn't drink too much.
Who were the other people? Who were the other lawyers who were doing
the kind of thing? Well, a fellow by the name of Tom Collins, it was very appropriate. And he was here for a number of years. He and I roomed together here. In those days, it was real hard to get a... You couldn't stay in a hotel except 6 days, as long as you could stay in a hotel, because it was so crowded, and you had to get out and give you 6 days to get some other place to stay. So we found a rooming house over here. And we couldn't get the meals there, but we both, two of us, stayed in a room together and ate our meals out.
Where was he from?
He was from Maryland. He stayed here and married a local girl here, and they moved back to Maryland. And I kept in contact with him a number of years. He died about 15 years ago. And I, of course, I really wasn't in that job too long, only about 4 months, and I went to the Corps of Engineers as attorney for them out at Fort, which is now Elmendorf, was Fort Rich at that time. But then my wife came up in like August or September, and we were married in service in 1942, and May the 9th, 1942, in Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. No, she was from Ohio. I met her in college, University of Alabama. Yeah, she stayed at Fort Monmouth, and she moved to New York and went to music school up there while I was in the service. So I stayed with the Corps of Engineers for about until November 1947, when I came down and went in as assistant to U.S. Attorney Ray Plummer. I became his assistant. He was U.S. Attorney, and I became his assistant in November 1947. I landed in April 22nd, 1946. I went there because that was the headquarters of OPA, and I was in training there for 10 days. Reading. I went there because I was assigned to Anchorage.
Did you meet Wilma Thurman when you were in
training? Yes. She was a forerunner of women's lib and women's rights in Alaska.
Why?
Well, I mean, she had a good job, she knew what she was doing, and she was very impressive in her job. She was an attorney.
Were there other lawyers that you met?
Yeah, Dorothy Tyner. She was, of course, a judge here. Dorothy Tyner was a judge here, and she was an attorney here, and she was district court, or what we call magistrate, when we first found the court system. Walter Walsh was down there. I met him. He met me at the plane the day I arrived in Juneau. And I will forget, he took me through the food stores there, and I looked it up on the counter, and there was half a dozen cucumbers there, and it said $2.50. And I said, you mean six cucumbers for $2.50? He said, no, one cucumber, $2.50. And that's what it was. One small cucumber was $2.50. The boat strike was on at that time. Mm-mm. You paid them. Everything came by air.
How long was the boat?
Last, as I recall, about 3 months. It was off and on. They had they were having strikes and labor problems all along. Finally, in 1953, I think the steamship just gave up any passenger service at all here, and all that was freight or barges. But they had trouble. Trouble with unions and whatnot.
But in 46, there was no
print service. The boat strike was on. They were flying everything in.
Was that when the steamship?
Alaska steamship.
Did they change?
Oh, they just quit coming up, except for they kept some of the freighters, but that was when they stopped the passenger service in 52. And they ran the freight service for a number of years, and finally the Tote came in and see Sealand came in, and then they had some barges, Alaska Western and whatnot, over the years ago.
Who else did you meet?
Oh, I met, trying to think, Tom Jensen. He came up here, and he's still around here somewhere. Tom Jensen was also an investigator with the OPA. No, he was not a lawyer. I don't recall what Tom, but he was an investigator anyway with OPA. All I knew, I'm trying to think who they were now. I knew all the attorneys in Juneau at that time, Mike Monago and Justice Boutchever was U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney down there at the same time I was assistant U.S. attorney here. Hugh Wade was down there. I knew him. He was Secretary of the Territory, as I recall. I think that's what they called her, auditor or something, back in those days. Mike Monagle, who was in Juneau, I knew him, and Fred Eastall, old-timers, Bobby Stahl's dad. If you lived in Juneau at all, you knew everybody within a few days.
How long were you
there? Oh, I was there then about 3 or 4 weeks, and it's hard to, looking back, whether I'm thinking about when I was first there, when I was Attorney General in the legislature, I knew him. Although there was a gap of about 10 years in there, but I'm sure I met all of them during that time because Mildred Herman knew all of them. But I got to know them better when I was in the legislature and when I was Attorney General. I came to Anchorage from Juneau after taking my training for an investigator down there. I came here, and in fact, Dorothy Tyner was my supervisor. Dorothy Tyner was our supervisor of, she was the attorney. Although we were attorneys, we were indicated investigators, and we were under Dorothy Tyner.
What was it like being with
Dorothy? No problem at all. Assumed that everybody knew what they were doing, and we didn't have any problem at all. So I guess we were the first women's lib people here. We had no problem at all.
What was Anchorage like?
Oh, I think we hunted moose and duck right here where we are now, and probably some grouse around. And as I recall, it was only 2 blocks paved, that's in front of the federal building and the city hall, is all that was paved at the time I came here. Of course, Club 25, that was way out of town at the time. Club 25 was there.
And this is way out of town for reality?
Yeah.
Where was
4th Avenue. And the old Lathrop building there, and this place here. This was a filling station here. This is a service station in town, the station right here. It was the oldest one, but no, there's one down way out the end of town.
Well, there was no building down there.
Well, the big building, they call the old Lingo building, a big white building, was at the end of the street. Did I recall it's 12 or 13?
Did you meet them all?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. Well, Pete Calamaritis got admitted at the same time I did. Okay, you had Stan McCutcheon, Bill Nesbitt, George Gregory, John Helenthal. John Manders, Bill Renfrew, Ed Davis. Name some other mouth. Just can't think of them. That's pretty close to them. Harold Butcher. He had been an attorney for OPA. Harold Butcher. I just met him. I know he was here. I know who he was, but he was just in the process of having some problems with the Bar Association, I think, about that time. I'm not sure if I, but he wasn't here very long. And then there was some other, Windblom, Noah Windblom. He had some problems too about it. And of course you had Ray Plummer and Earl Cooper, who were U.S. Attorney, Assistant U.S. Attorney. And Cal Moritas and I are about the same time. I'm trying to, offhand, if you...
Was there a Roach, Captain
Roach? Yeah, Roach. J.D., Judge Roach, they call him, Judge Roach. He had been a U.S. Commissioner at one time. General practice, most of them. I guess probably the most specialized practice would have, may have been Ed Davis. He confined himself to civil. Renfrew did all the criminal work. Davis represented one of the banks in, Cuddy was here also, and Wendell Kay came here about that time. Dan Cuddy's dad. Dan was admitted to the practice same year I was, but his dad was here, and Wendell Kay was in with him. Warren Cuddy. Oh, real nice guy. I mean, he's great help to any young attorney. Oh, he would take a man, or he'd give him advice, and you're always welcome to call him up. I mean, that was the beauty and the glory, I guess, of practicing law here, and everybody knew everyone. If a phone was working, you got on the phone if you had a problem, and they'd give you advice for free. I mean, you didn't have to have a consulting fee with them. And if they wanted you to do something while they were gone or something, you did it for them. I mean, it was very informal, but very effective and very good relationship. Dorothy Oz was here about that time, about the same time. She came here maybe a little after I did. Dorothy Oz, she was U.S. Commissioner over in Cordova. She came here as Judge McCurry's law clerk, I think, before she went over there. Or Judge Diamond or somebody. Goes down. And I'm trying to think of anything else. Of course, Rose Walsh was not even an attorney, and she was U.S. Commissioner here at the time. So. I can't think of it. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Wonderful gentleman. And so courteous to everyone, even when you didn't deserve to be courteous to you.
Can you give an example?
Oh, I mean, I think he was the most tolerant man I've ever known. I mean, you always found good in someone, regardless of how bad he'd been or how bad prepared he was. Paul came here while I was probably working for Corps of Engineers. He got here about the same time I did, so he'd probably be a contemporary, but he might have been here a few months before or a few months after.
Do you remember
best attorney in town. Never been to law school. He beat us all from time to time. I remember he did more to change the keeping of records in the court than anybody I know of. They were prosecuting him for forgery. And what they did in those days in all criminal cases, they kept all the evidence and exhibits in the file, and everybody came up and looked at them, they could see it. His original forgery check got misplaced, and they never did find it. So after that, they set up a different place to keep exhibits in criminal cases. So he changed a lot of things in regard to legal procedures here, because he's quite, he's quite good. I mean, he was better than some of us, or he worked harder than some of us. He won lots of cases. Oh, anybody can represent themselves, as you know. Regardless of how bad of an attorney you may be, you may represent yourself. In fact, he got that down to science. If he wanted to get in a case, he'd go buy an interest in property or real estate or something. He'd done it many times and come in and intervene.
What did the lawyers think of him?
Well, they thought he was a lot of trouble. To who he was. As I recall, he's someplace in the Middle West, but I'm really not certain. Well, I suspect the person who can tell you more about Will Q. Jefferson is probably Ray Plummer, if he's not Little Ray, but I mean the one who was district judge, because he was prosecuting him at that time, and that's the one. He's the one that found out that it wasn't safe to keep your exhibits in your file.
Oh, he was the one that did. Did Ed
James defend anything
on that one?
I think Bill Renfrew. It could have been Ed. I'm not sure.
So he never did join the
case? Oh, yeah. I think he served some time on that. They used, what they did, they used a copy they had. They had a copy of it.
Did you ever see when did you stop working for the OPA?
In November 1947, I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Left there in May of 51.
When did you move to Portland?
About July of 46 until November of 47, about a year and 4 months.
You really spent very little time at the
OPA. That's right, just a few weeks. We got training. In fact, on the wife of the real estate director of the Corps of Engineers was with OPA, and she was an investigator. She's on the, and she trained the same time I did. We came up on the plane, and she said, "I'm meeting my husband there, and he's looking for an attorney for the Corps of Engineers. Would you be interested?" I said, "Yeah, I'll talk to him." So we got off and met him, and we talked, and I was interested. And of course, it took about a month to get the transfer through. I transferred. He remained with OPA after I left, yes, and he finally, I think he's in private practice here for a while. OPA went out of existence, you know, sometime. He was here for, and then moved away. He married a school teacher here, what it was, and I think he's in private practice. I forget what he did, but he was here for some time, and then they finally moved back to Maryland, I believe it was. I was the attorney for the real estate department, examining titles, going out and looking at, we were acquiring property. Well, we were doing two things. We were acquiring property for the new Air Force base, And we were trying to give some property back that had been acquired during the war that they didn't want. So we were two things, trying to get rid of some and trying to acquire some. I remember we were trying to, what they had done, they'd used the airfield up at Nome. They had condemned that, but that was all gold land they had, and it was very expensive, and they'd never gone to a court hearing because they didn't. They could never get anyone to agree on how much gold was there as to what to pay for it. So I worked on, most of the time I was in there trying to get that returned. I never did, but I think they finally returned it to the owners and reached an agreement whereby they could keep the airfield there, but they could dig for gold on one wing at a time. And so they finally worked something out for them. And then we had some land. We had some land that hadn't been paid for, but had been acquired on a condemnation proceeding, but had never gone to trial. So some of that we were trying to turn back, and then really it worked out pretty good, because when I came in the U.S. Attorney's office, I took over finishing up the condemnation of some of that property. So I'd gotten knowledge down there, which helped me out.
Did you get up to
Oh, yes. I think Vonderheit was there, I'm not sure. I think he was there, Jim Vonderheit. And I'm not sure where, I'm trying to think of the attorney here that was there. I don't know whether he was there. He was there in 52. Well, it's Quincy Benton. I think he was there, because I know back in 52 when I went in private practice, he had just handled a case and they had fired him and hired us, Wendell Robinson, my firm. I went with Quincy Benton. Well, I don't know. Yeah.